It's a brand new episode of Lowdown Today. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Scott McLaughlin, Global Head of Football at Global Football Holdings. Scott, a big warm welcome to the show.
Connor, thank you for inviting me. I'm very aware of your work and the high level guests you've had before. So I'm now slightly nervous I can maintain the high standard of the podcast, but let's see how we go.
Well, for those that are watching as well on YouTube, I think we're just speaking off camera. Scott is also joined by his extensive collection of memorabilia, be it. I think I see a few Champions League footballs there in the background, Scott.
In lockdown, I started. I think many of us took up alternative pastimes in the additional spare time we had in lockdown. So I started putting the balls I've collected on my career journey into these plastic cases just to remind me and keep me in touch with the game while we worked in lockdown conditions. So that was one pastime, as well as returning to building Lego, which I found quite therapeutic, if I'm honest. I did several other people at the club at the time. So, no, thank you for recognizing each one is reminds me of an achievement that the club had or the clubs I've worked for have had. And sometimes it's nice to stop for a very short period of time and just reflect on the journey you've made.
I think that's the very first time I've heard about Lego and the Champions League being mentioned in tandem together on this podcast. But Scott, as you know, as a listener of this podcast, you know where we begin. Could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Yeah, I thought about this one this morning, Connor. I wanted to share probably the first and most powerful memory I've had. Okay. And this one's very much going to date me. So there'll be a lot of people in the audience who'll be saying, yeah, you probably look that old. My most powerful memory is 77, 78 season. And I very much recall having been brought up. I'm born in Glasgow and then coming from a very, very strong Scottish family and Scottish culture. At that time, the Scottish national team was the team that I was absolutely crazy about at that time, with their famous Umbro kit with the diamonds down the sleeves and the rampant lion on the chest. And they had Dalglish and Gemmell and Jordan and Masson and Alan Ruff in goal, all these famous players of that generation. And, Joe Jordan at that particular time was my hero because my father had worked at Greenock Morton as a youth coach and had been around and helped Joe a little bit in his formative years and retained a relationship. So through that connection, Joe Jordan was my hero, strangely, at that particular time. And Scotland went, as you may recall, you might have read a history book, had to play Wales in a playoff at Anfield, and my father attended the game and they beat Wales 2-0. To qualify for the 78 World Cup. And then that led me to be completely in awe of the 1978 World Cup in Argentina with the ticker tape and et cetera. We had a colour TV. So my grandpa came down from Glasgow and spent what was hoping to be a month with us watching Scotland win the World Cup. Because as you know, there was the famous Ali McLeod as Scotland's coach who'd convinced the whole country that Scotland could go to Argentina and win a World Cup, Ali's Army, as it was called at the time. And I just remember vividly the colours and the sounds on this television of Scotland being in a World Cup, the first World Cup that I actually remember following every single game, every single day. And that's my most powerful memory. Scotland losing to Cubillas's curly free kick to Peru, a terrible draw with Iran. And then being so close to qualification through the group by beating what was the remainder of the great Dutch team that eventually got to the final 3-2 and the famous Archie Gemmell goal. All of the colour, sounds, and mythology of that particular tournament was a really, really powerful memory for me, not only from the football, but obviously who I shared it with at that particular time was really powerful for me.
And you speak of there, you know, that Scottish 1978 World Cup appearance in Argentina being a prominent feature of your youth, and I would suspect it would play a huge influence in the worldly journey that you've taken in a beautiful game of football that is Scott. But just touching upon there, the Scottish upbringing, how would you say how prominent a role that upbringing played and where you got to?
Yeah, I think it played a huge part in it. I was reflecting on this just this week. football was a huge part of my father's life. He played it, he'd taken his coaching badges with the Scottish FA, had been around the elite practitioners at the time, Alex Ferguson and some of the others of that age, been in their cohorts in the classes, in the coaching licenses. But he'd always been unable to, at that time, the game was different, far less people around teams, less full-time jobs. He'd been unable to take his love and passion of the game into a full-time role. He still retained his job in industry. So I didn't realize until I reflect on it quite recently that I'd probably been around football quite a lot in my formative years. I would follow my father to games, be inside dressing rooms, follow into training sessions, etc. So maybe subliminally I was picking up as a very young child the workings of a football environment, dressing room interactions, etc. That maybe I didn't realize I'd built a foundation at an early age that I then brought forward when I started to make it my own personal career. But football was a huge part of our weekly schedule of events. My father would work in his job during the day, and then there'd be training sessions, two or three times a week, and games on a Saturday and a Sunday. So all of our family schedule revolved around my father and his football, to the point where my brother and I then became play, began old enough to play in our own right. And then it just became three of us in the house, navigating as many football opportunities as we could week on week. As far as the Scottish aspect is concerned, you'll instantly recognize I don't have a very strong Glaswegian accent. I'm sure people listening will go, well, you can't be Scottish. I left there really quite early in my life to go to the Manchester area and then subsequently down to London. So when you change schools and environments at that young an age, your dialect is very quickly adjusted to your environment. But I will say the values and work ethic of a tough Glaswegian neighborhood such as Govan, where our family were from, was very, very evident in all of my upbringing. That's for sure.
It's fair to say coaching runs in the family blood, and needless to say, Scott, you do have a passion for coaching, and as evoked from your very early days as a development coach at Wimbledon. But I mean, last time we spoke last week, it was interesting. You alluded to the fact that you kind of maybe lost that touch or lost that sense of feeling regarding that passion for coaching over time. But could you please tell everyone listening how it was reignited during what was otherwise a treacherous time for a lot of people during COVID at Chelsea?
I can clearly say the COVID experience was remarkably difficult for many football clubs to navigate, as you can imagine. And I think clearly terribly disappointing for the fans who enjoy the congregational aspects of turning out to the club every single week. It plays a huge part in the community socially for all of our fans. But perhaps not so many people realise that for the scouting teams in many of these bigger clubs who travel around Europe or broader parts of the world to scout players, that whole aspect of live scouting was stopped at that particular point in many, many clubs. It was just unsafe to be on aeroplanes and in stadiums, and there was unique restrictions in every single country. So we had to find other ways of doing our work and continuing to identify talent on behalf of the clubs. So, but secondary to that, we had a little bit more time on our hands because we weren't all travelling on aeroplanes and trains and etc. to get to where we needed to be. So we had to fill the time. And I felt a very huge responsibility at such a acute time where we didn't really know what the future was going to be and how long COVID was going to last and what the ongoing effects of it would have been for our industry, that I realised it was a unique opportunity to look inwardly again and focus on who we were. Could we really, really double down and rebuild or uplift the competency framework of each of our scouts? And I realized that my role then was to kind of shift from being a leader of the scouting team. It afforded me an opportunity to be a bit of a coach again, not coaching on the grass in the traditional sense, but it was an opportunity to take our group of scouts and say, okay, let's see if we can grow each individual's competency framework, the benefits of which would have been to keep us relevant for the club, at that particular time so we could continue to do our job, maybe in a better way. But also, with the uncertainty of how long COVID would last, it would provide them perhaps an uplift in their marketability should anything terrible happen and we'd all have to look for new jobs. So it was a way of future-proofing our group. And we really, really enjoy, I thoroughly enjoy trying to design workshops on some of the various skills that we would use as scouts to try and uplift everybody. So we did things on the science of observation, classifying behaviors. What is the measurement of a player observer? How would you actually measure a player's performance? The real skill of report writing is a real skill, believe it or not. You know, how you write a document for an audience is a real guile and skill required in how you shape that. So we did those kind of workshops, and then we also did a huge amount of work on using the work of Tetlock. Did a lot of work on the skill of forecasting and prediction. So we found it interesting. It was really, really good fun.
You spoke there at the very start, Scott, in terms of getting back in touch with yourself and rediscovering that spark and that passion for coaching. Can you see how easy it perhaps is for people to kind of lose what got them into the football industry as a core skill, be it getting from zero to one? And necessarily aren't the skills that are going to take you from two to 10. It's an interesting dichotomy because the Peter principle in football, what gets you in terms of the competency, you keep rising, rising, rising until you're no longer competent. So is that kind of an, I suppose, an unwelcome truth about being involved in an industry that is such 24/7 as is the football industry?
Yeah, I think over the time I've been in the business, I've seen a huge amount of people very, very enthusiastic and driven and determined to get into the business. But the number that actually have a plan of how they're going to continue their personal growth once they get in, actually it sometimes is quite a different number of people. So it's like, I'll give you, a personal example. I remember becoming a father for the first time, and I read so many books about pregnancy and what was going to happen up to the pregnancy, and I did all the courses. But very few people actually tell you what it would be like on day one you start being actually a father and your child's arrived, right? So it's like, oh, everyone, it's almost like there's a 9 month horizon and no one tells you what it would be like from day one till your child's an adult. And that's a real shock to the system, or it was for me. So I can imagine getting into a football club is only part of it. And it's unknown unknowns, right? You don't know what it's actually like working in a football club until you get in a football club. And there's also so many football clubs with so many different cultures and processes and methodologies that there's always going to be a learning gap until you get in. And then you have to use your intuition to figure out what gets you to the next place you want to be. And I've been a strong advocate over time of learning the skill of actually trying to map that out rather than be instinctive in navigating where you go. I'm terribly process oriented. I'm sure some of the people who worked alongside me will tell you I'm quite fastidious when it comes to that. And I'm quite structured in writing down where I need to be at a certain time and then filling in the tasks that need to be done to get to there and ticking them off. So I think having a career map is a really important thing if you're a young person trying to get into the industry. Having the starting point and the end point's the easy bit, but how you then fill in the mile markers as you go along towards that is a little bit more difficult and nuanced, is my thing.
And having that career map, would that be written as a sole individual, or would you have that co-written with others?
In my case, I've written it as an individual, but then obviously I would have the people that I need to meet and network with and contact and have contact with written into each line as my next mile marker, as I call them, on the way to where I need to be.
It's an interesting one to dissect because it'd be fascinating to explore your mind on that, Scott. Would there be minimizing gaps? Would you be speaking about getting into certain levels with clubs, or would you be speaking about acquiring different skill sets?
Acquiring different skill sets.
Interesting.
Originally, at the very, very start, it would have been about getting qualification. So I would have, right, preliminary badge. I'm dating myself again with a preliminary badge. People won't know what that is. Basically, a level one coaching badge. And that would be right, level one coaching badge. Who do I need to contact? How long does it take? Okay, then what's the next badge? What experience do I need to have between those two? I need to visit clubs, right? Which clubs can I contact and reach? What coach is going to go and watch live work to grow my repertoire of coaching drills or whatever? And then you build it up layer by layer towards your next qualification. And I've kind of mapped my career over time in that way. And obviously, it's a living document. It's a piece of paper that you can change and adjust as you go along, depending on each experience.
Actually quite fascinating, and I presume you have you that living one right now with the 30 plus years of your footballing experience all entailed into one.
Yeah, listen, this last one, this present role has been a really, really big challenge for me, and it's really, really opened my mind to the broader spectrum of roles and tasks required in a football club, and the complexity of it. So I've been on a pretty steep learning curve recently in my new role, which has really, really been motivating and inspiring again to be challenged by something that's a little bit at the edge of your comfort zone. And that's a really, really special place to be, probably where the best learning is done, right? When you're feeling what's that? Consciously uncomfortable is where I am, quite frankly, at times, yeah.
Consciously uncomfortable. I mean, Global Football Holdings comprising of seven different clubs, Scott. I mean, what was that onboarding process like, even arriving into the building, getting to understand all the different dynamics of play, understanding all unique cultures and people?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I thought very, very carefully about this. I've been very, very privileged over my time at the last role at Chelsea to be able to travel the world as part of the scouting team identifying talent. And one of the latent benefits of that was that you developed an understanding of the cultural nuances, identities, the culture, and the heritage of many, many markets across the beautiful game. Traveled extensively in South America and all over Europe. So, repeated trips to these areas allowed me to build up this knowledge of the structure in those countries, things like regulatory frameworks, player pathways, network interactions in that country, and then who that country actually trades with and doesn't trade with, and trade routes of players. You start to build up this mind map of the global football landscape. But I think the human aspect of it was really, really important to understand where football sits within each culture, the importance of it, how it's grown, the identity of it, etc. So entering into GFH, I think I relied on that knowledge a great deal. I was very, very cautious to make sure that I benefited from two ears, one mouth. That it was very, very important to listen to the people in each of these clubs to quickly understand where they are, where they think they are in the evolution of their club, what they think they're good at, what they think they're bad at. And I think you have to be really, really comfortable when you do this task being the most foolish person in the room. And that people tell had to ask lots of questions and glean knowledge from the practitioners in each of our clubs. And that allowed me to then build a knowledge of the landscape and the ecosystem of these clubs to then work collaboratively with our teams in each of the clubs to decide how we're going to incrementally move towards our performance objective. I think that was a far better way. It's a better way of building rapport, relationships, and trust a little bit quicker. There's a famous phrase, right? You have to walk in someone's shoes. So you have to go into these clubs and actually understand how they work day to day in those organizations before you can make any firm judgment on the direction of travel. That was my strategy.
And going into obviously each separate club, you know, they require different things, you know, they're at different stages of the change management cycle. In terms of, did that process of observation last for a predefined period of time for each, or would it vary?
It varied. It varied, but I'd say, that's a 4 to 6 month process to get around all of these clubs enough times to develop relationships, look at all of the primary functions you wish to analyze in a structured audit style process. And as you say, it's a very good observation you make there, you know, because every club, the life cycle of a football club, I think is, you know, is quite similar to the life cycle of a business. You know, are you a startup? Are you accelerating it? Are you transitioning, or are you trying to sustain what the present performance level is? And I think understanding where each of the clubs in the GFH network is, and then where we wish for them to be, was a really critical part of my early days in the organisation. Mapping out where we are and where we truly believe each of these clubs can be.
And speak to us too about managing that workflow, Scott, because obviously it's something managing a portfolio of scouts at Chelsea, but it's another thing managing a portfolio of clubs, as we speak about, all with different visions, all with different sized of gaps to be minimized to that ideal vision. Obviously, then you're tasked with mobilizing certain resources. How did you manage the day to day amidst all of this?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So, to give it some broader context, I'm very, as we said before we started the discussion a little bit, right? I am purely in love with the game of football. Every single small detail of the game, I still find a huge level of interest in and passion for. Be that what's the latest football boot, what kits have been released this year, what footballs are out this year, what's the design of the football, and what's its messaging. I still love absolutely everything about the game, and I think I view it very much from a that love of the game informs and drives how I interact with all of these football clubs. I think I'm quite capable of building a rapport with the people in each of these markets, and also the community that they serve and they represent. So it's very, very important for me to recognise that each of the clubs is unique in that regard. Whilst they all play football, how that each club has grown its identity, its culture, and the heritage that it's evolved, each of those is actually unique, first and foremost. So then you have to cater your communication, volume, frequency, cadence to suit each of those environments and map it out. We want the people in each of our clubs to be forward facing and the leaders of their club. If you imagine 7 restaurants in one street of all different flavors of or styles of cookery, we're kind of the, but they're all serviced by one kitchen in the back, let's say, right? So we're that's how I wish for it to be, because no matter how long how many times I visit these clubs and I'm in these clubs, I won't perhaps have that real deep intuitive knowledge for that community because I don't live in that community. So it's very, very important that we have strong leaders and custodians front of house in each of these organizations. And as you say, the week-to-week workload is now pretty much set in a series of calls and meetings where we upload what's going on in each of the clubs. And then I have a regular schedule of visits to these clubs to progress on topics or projects they're working on in each of the zones, which is gives me a really diverse, varied, exciting, and stimulating schedule every single week.
As you spoke of there, being obviously aware of how you are with your cadence and your tone and tailoring different communication styles to each of the 7 restaurants, let's say, how has someone where coaching has played a prominent role throughout your career to that, and someone who's studied coaching extensively, how have you had to better yourself as a coach over the past year?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's reminded me that you have to be really, really targeted and careful in the planning of your communication. I think I remember back to my very, very early days as a coach where I had to write every single coaching session down on a piece of paper for me to believe that it actually had a structure and a progression. I remember doing that. But as you built up your competence and it became more intuitive and you could remember things from memory and recall them and put the session on without a piece of paper, I've kind of gone all the way back to the start and realized that for me to have a better communication with the people in the clubs, a more beneficial communication, and maybe to have some of our ideas gather traction quicker, I need to be very, very careful in how I communicate, what I communicate, and when you communicate it so that you actually get buy-in and action, the appropriate action you require for the idea that you're introducing. And I've become self-taught to some degree in how to script a meeting and think ever more carefully about all of the nuance around a meeting. And I know that you are an advocate and a listener and have an interest in Chris Voss's work the same way I do. And I remembered his, I think it's is it 7:38:55 rule, right? About people remember a little bit of your content, a lot about the tone of your voice, and lastly, mostly they remember your body language. So I've tried to be an advocate of that and really, really work on those three stimuli that people take from you, of how you communicate, and really double down and try and work to improve my performance in each of those three sectors.
And going through that process of discovery, obviously we're speaking about communication styles and whatnot, but what about you yourself, Scott? Did you learn anything specific about yourself previously unbeknownst to yourself?
I think I've learned to be a little bit slower and more considered in my communication. I am, by definition, passionate and quite energetic, speak too quickly at times because I get quite carried away with the topic we might be discussing and can be immersed in a variety of topics quite quickly because I think I'm generally quite inquisitive. And ideas rush into my mind to ask many, many more questions. But when you're working across multinational, multilingual teams, you have to be really, really careful how you communicate. And if I go back to my time at Chelsea, I worked for 10 managers in 11 years. So continuing to rebuild that rapport with every single coach who was one of our core clients. The head coach was always a core client for our department. You think, wow, 10 and 11 is a lot of years. But the added part to that is that it took to Frank Lampard, who was coach number nine, I think, in my journey. Frank was the first English speaking coach I had in my journey. First one with English as his native language. Yeah, there was many who spoke English, but what I learned over time, and what I only learned when Frank came, was how that accelerated communication, and by accelerating communication, in turn, had the opportunity to accelerate decision making. So, some of the other coaches we'd had in the past, the only way we could interact with that coach was in an official meeting style, in a room, quiet. Door closed so that that person could understand what we were saying and translate it in his mind to his native tongue so we understood the messaging. If he had some English, perhaps that their vocabulary was restricted in English and wasn't as deep as ours. And it wasn't until Frank came that I realized that what the famous water cooler conversation or the shout down the corridor to each other or the informal casual conversation could be had with Frank because we had the same language, and all of the jargon and phrases that football has around it now, which changes season on season, all these buzzwords and phrases we use, we could use those to each other in an intuitive way, and we understood what the inference was in that messaging, and that made communication easier and sped communication, and you could have all the different interactions with Frank in different parts of the building, and it was intuitively and quickly understood rather than having to have it in a formal way. So that was a really big lesson because then bringing that to the present day, I've got to figure out which ones in these clubs I can communicate that way and which ones I have to communicate in a more formal, structured meeting to make sure my message gets across. That was a really key learning for me.
And touching upon that, and Scott, something you spoke of earlier on, football is a 24/7 business, and obviously it's a complex equation as it's a product, about performance managed by a person. So then you in your own role as a leader, how do you manage to foster a learning environment in a place where most people are head down and backside up?
Yeah, I have been since 1992 on a perpetual learning journey. So trying to motivate people to realize that individual growth and career progression very much in this business relies on you being a perpetual learner, I think. So I've lost count of the pounds I've spent with the English Football Association on my learning journey. But I think as a leader of several teams now, I make time to review people's performance and to encourage them to find ways of growing their competency. I've just reading a really good book at the moment by the famous Adam Grant, Hidden Gems, and I was just reading a chapter just this week about the actual learning journey and the rate of development, and there's a little bit in the chapter where he's speaks about languishing. And I think as football's evolved a little bit, where we've got so many roles around a team now and people are in narrower job description bandwidths, some people I think get a little bit stale and get stuck in a role and find it very, very hard to continue their career. There's a lot of competition, as you know. It's a very aspirational industry, and you get put into a specialism now. Whereas I think I very much benefited in my formative years in this business working for a club like Wimbledon, where at a time where there was a lot less staff around the club, it was harder to get a full-time job because of that. But once you got in, you're tasked with doing several jobs. And I think my benefit and my longevity in the business to some degree has been down to the fact that I'm more a generalist than a specialist. I remember at times at Wimbledon, I was the under-9s coach, I was the first team analyst, I was the opposition scout. So I was doing three jobs for that club, which pretty much took up 6 or 7 days a week. And that afforded me learning experiences because they trusted you. Those learning experiences that I see a younger generation probably don't get now. So I think it's important to seek out other learnings. Try to interact with other departments, either side of the department you're in. If you're running in a club, figure out where it fits in the big jigsaw puzzle of the club, and ask questions, and find ways of expanding your knowledge in that way. Because as Adam Grant says, you don't want to be on the mountain doing the circular route to the summit, where you feel you're not actually progressing, but you're progressing at a slow rate by going around the mountain rather than the quickest way up the north face. And yeah, I think being very, very inquisitive and working hard to understand where your part fits with the other parts, and expanding your knowledge and trying to be a bit more of a generalist is really, really important. It's something I think about sports directorship. I know the sports director is a very interesting role at the moment, an emerging specialism. But how many of the sports directors actually have had experience working in the different departments that they're ultimately tasked with managing? And I think it's important when you go into a club and you can go into the analysis department and the guy says, look, you just don't know how hard it is here. I'm working at 2 a.m. reviewing last night's game. You can go, yeah, listen, I've actually done that in my career. I've been up till 3 a.m. trying to put a data set together for your coach the next morning. And that builds rapport. So I think sports directorships at the moment come from primarily probably the recruitment space. Mostly, I think at the moment, many of the sports directors have been scout stroke recruitment people. But the sports director role also encompasses a huge part of the performance domain, right? So where is their experience and their knowledge, and what is their depth of knowledge of those particular aspects? So I think being a specialist is where the game's moving more and more. But I think there's still great credit and credibility in being a generalist if you're going to be a manager or a leader of a whole group.
I think the beauty is
Think
that.
I think Epstein says that in his book Range, right? It's really, really important that you have a range of experiences and a
Yes.
range of knowledge that you can then plug into any problem and perhaps offer a different perspective to answer that problem. That's where it is for me, building that expert experiences.
It's the ephemeral Tiger Woods versus Roger Federer debate. And my own subjective opinion on this is I think the beauty is in the role of the generalist because, football as a theory of everything. Little did the boy know who was standing in front of that TV watching 1978 World Cup, Scott, that, football would be a vessel of which you could learn a lot more about sociology, ethnography, communication, so on and so forth. And I think we can't afford to lose that. And it's something which strikes me about your own learning journey. I know we've had WhatsApp conversations, back and forth and various different things, but how kind of broad and diverse ranges of your inspiration are in terms of looking outside from the cuckoo nest that is football and bringing it back into your own leadership path.
Yeah, something I, as you'll appreciate, my previous employer was a big name in the sports industry, and that afforded you many, many wonderful experiences to interact with different industries. And I was very, very determined from the start to take full advantage of the learning opportunities. So I've been around quite a large swathe of the American sports industry to view it through their lenses. I've been in industry at various places to see how that's worked. And before I was full-time in football, I worked in my father's business in the automotive trade. So I had an understanding of managing people and managing a business. I ran my father's business at 21 years of age. So I'd worked in sort of, let's say, the real world a little bit before I came into football in my late 20s. So I had some understanding of how businesses work, departments work, structures before I came into the football world. But I've continued to be remarkably inquisitive in lockdown. As we said, there was a little bit of time in lockdown to do some different stuff. I took it upon myself to start emailing authors of books that I'd read to try and get an hour of their time on Zoom to explain the rationale for writing the book. Was there any deeper learnings they had as the author for the book, and discussing some of the prime chapters in the books that I thoroughly enjoyed. I've been a huge attendee at many, many conferences in different places to try and find learning. Last week, I had the huge privilege of being at the RAF Red Arrows, which is a really, really, for a man of my age, a little red jets flying across the sky doing skills was as exciting as it got when I was a kid. So that was a really interesting experience to learn from them about team culture, communication, feedback, talent development. It was a really, really interesting experience. What I have learned, I think, learning is one thing and is fantastic, and having a broad range and a diverse range of learning is really, really important. But I think to continue your career to be successful, at some point that learning has to turn into an actionable behavior, and it has to have benefit for who you're working for at that given time. Otherwise, you're just a collector of knowledge rather than a practitioner who uses knowledge. And it's very, very easy to be overly saturated with new ideas, but you've got to be able to assimilate the information at all of these learning opportunities and turn them into a beneficial behavior for your organization that you can then action with your peers. And that's quite a difficult thing. I think it's very, very good to gather information, but to be able to join the dots of that information, of how it suits your organization, when it's going to suit your organization, and who you need to help you action that is a really, really important aspect of learning that I took time to learn actually. I tended to be a collector of information, but it took me some time to understand how I could turn the information and the knowledge into an actionable behavior. That's probably a key learning I've taken in the last 8 to 10 years, I would say.
And in going from learning to action, and for all those people listening to this today, Scott, at various different, iterations of their own footballing journey, what for you was the single biggest domino that needed to fall?
Wow, that's a tough question. The single biggest domino that needed to fall for me to understand where I was going in my career, yeah.
To go from learning, from going from just pure knowledge to actually implementation.
I think the crystallization of that was probably when I actually got to Chelsea, when I realized that I had responsibility for a big, big department of 20 people that were global and that had a high responsibility to be elite and to perform. And I went, okay, right, now I really need to lean on all that I've learned and try and shape that into a program of work, an ethos and culture in our department that was going to see this be a leading scouting team. And I think the really, really exciting thing at that point was there was a great scope to be able to do that. I think I was very, very fortunate that I got into the talent ID and scouting space just as it was becoming a far more professional aspect of a club. We wanted to be at the forefront of that. We wanted to be pioneers of professionalizing scouting. We wanted it to be seen as a career. I think people view their job in three ways, perhaps. I think I've read this in the past. It's either a job, which is a means to an end. It's a job that I earn money because I need food, my family. Then there's a career that you believe in it enough that you're going to be in it for a long time and you enjoy it. And then I suppose there's the last one is like the calling thing that you think, right, this is me. This is what I'm really, really passionate about, that you're fully immersed in the role. And I think when I fell into scouting at that time, that's where I was. Our purpose was to professionalize scouting as an organization. And then we went on a 10-year journey across all of the club scouting practices to be able to do that. And that meant that we had to be really open-minded to all of the different ways we could increase and find a gain in our practices. And that was a really, really exciting time with some wonderful people at the club to try and develop this whole identity as a professional scouting department and what that actually looked like. That was a really, really exciting project to bring all of your learning up to that point, and then try and distill it into this one particular project at Chelsea. It was a very, very exciting time for us.
And I think as a leader, you took that identity piece to heart. And it's something which I've noticed from just listening to you today on the podcast in terms of being visible and being there for your people. Scott, I know you're a key proponent of the shop floor mindset. So as someone who's walked down the halls of football clubs, throughout countless of years, you've been obviously responsible for, I would say, a variety of different iterations of people and generations. How has your own leadership style, very curious to learn a little bit more about how has that had to involve the latest cohort of people, practitioners?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. If I think I've probably spanned and worked in the business through one of the biggest changes in management and leadership culture, I think. I think when I started in the 90s, it was very much a leader follower paradigm. Okay, football was still very much about the manager as the head of the club, and it was still quite militaristic in its interaction between players and staff and the manager and the hierarchy. So it's and that was also how I'd grown up in the academic system, and perhaps a little bit the relationship with my father. That was sort of generation at the time. But I think we've certainly evolved technology supported younger people to understand they've got a voice and can have an opinion on many, many broad topics. Social media's driven that as well. Television's driven that and the change in society. And I realized over the last 10 years of my journey where I've led teams that you have to move and change your leadership style. I think at the very, very start of the journey, I was a product of my generation, let's say, and quite comfortable trying to be a leader in the leader follower paradigm and telling people where we were going. But I think I had an epiphany a few years through the Chelsea journey where I realized that we'd transitioned and rebuilt the scout team with younger, dynamic people who were more had a more diverse range of skills, were technologically proficient, could understand and assimilate data, that we were changing who our workforce were. And aligned to that, they were changing what their ambitions and their career aspirations were. And I was very, very eager to support people on their journey back to the wanting to coach people and see people improve. So we pivoted at one moment in time to completely change how the whole of that department was run. And we restructured the department to empower the scouts to pretty much run their own regions. And then we realized that there was huge value in co-creation and collaborating on all manner of things, processes, procedures, strategy, communication. We just had a really open and transparent style of management that I think fitted two purposes. One, people felt invested, respected, and cherished because they had a say. We gave them a voice. Secondly, you were growing their skills for them to ultimately be a leader. And my ambition was for some of the guys in the department to ultimately overtake me or take my role. I was confident that that was my duty, was to try and get them to that level. Our so-called scout school that we ran in that way to improve these people ended up being really quite successful, with alumni from our department now working in Manchester City, Palermo, Bayern Munich, Liverpool, etc. So we've had some people that passed through that department and worked under our care in our systems and co-created those systems, took benefit from that learning to then go on to a higher role in their career somewhere else. And they remain strong friends and a strong connection with our alumni, and we're proud. And I wanted Chelsea to be able to produce football executives, let's say, chief scouts or whatever, as much as we could produce players. That was a really important aspect of the strategy, was can we grow people as well as identifying players? And I think we've been relatively successful at that over the period of time.
And it strikes me when you speak, Scott, and it kind of reaffirms this lingering suspicion that I do have an awful lot of successful people, I would say, within the football industry that come on this podcast. They have this thing in common. And what I liken it to is the second mountain, the book about the two peaks. And the first peak always in someone's career, especially in football industry, seems to be a race to the summit to understand, and to kind of bequeath within them in terms of that passion for what they really want to do in the game of football. Then I would say the second peak is much more of a patient ascent to get to that goal over time. And as someone's as esteemed such as yourself, who's had profound impact at the clubs you've been, the alumni that you brought through scouting departments, all the different Champions League and Europa League balls in the background. Well, what is really exciting you about global football holdings and your own future?
Yeah, I took this particular role because my constant learning journey dictated that I should always seek a stretch. And I think 11 years is a remarkable body of work at a club such as Chelsea. And I was very, very privileged and cherished every opportunity that it gave. But I embarked on the FA's technical director's course through lockdown. And I had committed that every single learning opportunity I had wasn't just for the sake of a certificate on the wall to say I achieved it. It had to then be used to benefit and grow me further, and was just a way of opening another level of experience for me. And over time, in the last period of time at Chelsea, I realized, listen, I maybe need to see, I need another stretch here. Because the longer you run a department, if you run it the way that we had at the time, was that you want to empower everybody and you want them to grow the competency framework to challenge you. The other side of that is that you delegate more and more and more, and you empower those people. So where do you find your next period of growth? Okay, where is that for me? And I had aspirations to be a sports director at some point because I'd done the course. I really saw great value in that and thought that my preceding 20 odd years of experience had given me a broad range of skills that I think would benefit me and support me to uphold the role of a sports director. Now, I've learned from somebody more better educated than me that the perfect candidate for a role doesn't exist. And I think the most you'll get is maybe an 80% fit on any candidate. So I was very, very fortunate to find people in Global Football Holdings who appreciated the journey I had to this point, my experiences to this point, and my values that I have, and were prepared to invest in me to fill maybe the 15% that I didn't have to be a complete candidate for this particular role. So my great joy at the moment is being exposed to these clubs across different cultures in different markets and trying to develop my understanding of these markets, whilst also growing some of the critical competencies I'll need to be a leader of such a broad, diverse, dynamic group of clubs on a daily basis, and moving myself from practitioner to perhaps being comfortable being more of a strategist. As I said several times through the conversation, I'm really, really passionate about the game. That leads to being perhaps too eager to go into the weeds on some of the topics. Okay, I mean, I'll happily stand with the groundsman, Chris, the English groundsman we've got at Bromby, and talk about the state of his pitch and what's the length of the grass you've cut for the game this week, or I'll speak to another club about, can we. What's the travel tracksuit going to look like next year? And I'm sure some people think that's probably going a little bit too far down into the weeds, but I love every single aspect of this business, 360 degree immersion into what the business is. But I think I'm on a journey to try and be even more strategic in my leadership, and then try and leverage my learnings through that rather than purely through being a practitioner. There's a time to be a practitioner and show you still know it, but I'm actually still working to try and find what's the optimal balance in that regard, being honest.
Absolutely fantastic. I think I'll be joining a lot of people going back through the way to this podcast, Scott. Like, I have countless lessons galore here in the notepad to my right. But before we wrap things up, I mean, for those people listening that are even slightly bit inspired to follow you and your journey and thread a similar path, what would be the one bit of key advice you'd have for them?
Yeah, I've thought about this one. Something it took me a long time to realize, and still, even to this day, sometimes I'm unaware. I think that there's a lot of people in this business, or perhaps there's a lot of people in this business, but definitely for me, I've suffered to some degree with imposter syndrome. It's such a competitive business off the pitch as much as it is on it. The roles are cherished. Many, many people aspire to be in the business and are working really hard to be in it. So to have been in it as long as I have, I don't take that lightly. I cherish every single opportunity, and it's been a real privilege to work with the many, many colleagues and the leaders and the clubs that I've worked for. But it took me quite some time, to be honest, probably too long, because I think I'm quite immature mentally. I think my mental age is quite some way behind my physiological age. But I think in some ways that's a benefit, because having a young outlook on the game, and it's a young person's game, right? I think one of the big benefits here is that you get to be around young, energetic, dynamic people. I think that's one of the great benefits of being inside a football club. It's actually a really, really special place to be when you're around elite performers of such a young age. It's really, really inspiring. But aligned to that is that there's a pressure to perform at some of the clubs I've worked for. They're really huge organizations that demand success. And I've perpetually asked myself whether I'm actually good enough to be wherever I am. And that small level of fear, not fear in a fear for my safety kind of way, but fear that it might be taken away or am I good enough, has been a real primary driver for me over all of my career. But maybe I wish a little bit, it's taken me perhaps too long in my career to really back myself and talk to my inner self that I actually am good enough to do something and really believe in myself. So I think a message to people out there is be confident and be brave and really reach for what you really want to be. Be braver to put yourself in uncomfortable situations and really see whether you can grow into it as you journey. I think I was a little bit too risk averse in the early years of my career. And overcome some of my inner fears about whether I was really good enough. So that would be my message, is really be brave, take brave decisions and back yourself and align that with the continual learning, and then you'll certainly have the skills to fill the gaps in as you journey through the career.
McLachlan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have spent the last hour beside yourself.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and listening to my story. Thank you for your time.